Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I'm Brett Baer.
I'm Maria Bartiromo.
I'm Brian Kilmeade, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Monday, November 7th, 2022. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. From coast to coast, crime is on voters' minds ahead of these midterm elections, with some polls showing it's rivaling, even topping inflation as a concern, depending on the area.
It's something that I think the American people have caught on to, because if you do look at the polling data, not only does it show that crime is a really big concern, but it also shows that Republicans are enjoying really large margins of advantage on that issue.
I'm Jared Halpern. Voters tell us it's the economy weighing heaviest as they head to the polls. We take a look at what the numbers tell us about the nation's financial well-being.
So the labor side of their mandate is perfect. The inflation part, the price stability part of their mandate is a mess, and they have to get that under control.
And I'm Tammy Bruce. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Crime has registered as a critical voter concern this election cycle. A recent Gallup poll found 56% of U.S. adults feel there's been an increase in crime where they live. That's the highest number in Gallup's trend going back to the early 70s. In one recent poll of New York voters, concerns about crime topped even inflation, and the Republican candidate for governor, Lee Zeldin's, been critical of incumbent Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul on this issue, including at their Spectrum One-hosted debate.
You got people who are afraid of being pushed in front of oncoming subway cars. They're being stabbed, beaten to death on the street with hammers.
Anyone who commits a crime under our laws, especially with the change we made to bail, has consequences. I don't know why that's so important to you.
To the other coast, it's resonating with Oregon voters, too, where a Republican may win for governor in this blue state. During a debate, the Democratic candidate Tina Kotek went first on a question about hiring more police officers, followed by the Republican candidate Christine Drazen.
I've always supported our state police. It's important to have state police around the state.
Tina Kotek is the original defund the police candidate. She did not support police even when rioters were attacking a police station.
And in that KGW-hosted debate, the independent candidate, Betsy Johnson, sided with the Republican. It's an issue that's put Democrats on defense. In Pennsylvania, where Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman is the Democratic Senate candidate, Dr. Mehmet Oz, the Republican, says Fetterman, as chair of the Board of Pardons, increased commutations for those serving life prison terms.
I'm a county sheriff, veteran, and Pennsylvania. I'm sick of Oz talking about John Fetterman and crime. Here's the truth. John gave a second chance to those who deserved it.
The FBI crime stats for 2021 found murders increased 4%, but that data didn't include data from several big cities. They estimated that robberies declined while rape and property crimes increased. But that was last year. For the first 6 months of this year, the Council on Criminal Justice found, after reviewing data from nearly 30 big cities, homicides declined just 2% compared to the same time last year, though aggravated assaults, burglaries, and especially robberies were up.
What we saw in 2020 was unprecedented, right? The homicide spike of 30% year over year in 2020 was the single largest one-year homicide spike in the nation's history.
Rafael Manguel is the head of research for the Police and Public Safety Initiative at the Manhattan Institute.
That's going to be really disconcerting for people who have essentially grown used to steadily declining crime for about a quarter century. I mean, obviously, that decline hasn't been universal. There have been some parts of the country that have been struggling with crime in the interim. But, you know, when you have a national spike on that level coming after massive protests and riots, this just very visible disruption in public order, that is going to make people feel particularly uneasy, especially when that's happening in our sort of big population centers, cities like Los Angeles and New York and Chicago and Houston, Philadelphia and Baltimore. When you start to see that kind of deterioration, that really, you know, gets our antennas up as you know, people who are just concerned with safety as really the number one duty of government. And, you know, the reason I think it's become such a big issue in the midterms is because it's one of those issues that's particularly important, but also where there's a very stark contrast between the two dominant political parties, right? I mean, Republicans are essentially campaigning on getting tougher, on putting more people behind bars for longer, on being more aggressive in terms of policing, whereas Democrats are essentially continuing to push down the decarceration and depolicing line, you know, saying that we need fewer people incarcerated, that we have a mass incarceration problem, that we have too much policing and too much police brutality, and have essentially branded themselves as the party that is going to stand up against the institutions that most people remember as being the providers of the public safety of the last 30 years that we've grown so used to.
Rafael, to that point, you know, a lot of Democrats on the campaign trail, including former President Obama, they say if you want to talk about crime, the places actually with the highest rates of violent crime per capita are red states. I think I saw that in 2020, at least on one graphic, the states with some of the highest violent crime rates were like Mississippi, Louisiana, Kentucky, Alabama. Is that the case? Is that what the data shows you as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case at the state level, but that's really doesn't tell you very much. I mean, for one thing, state-level crime measures aggregate crime that isn't experienced in the aggregate, right? The state-level crime measure isn't going to tell you how safe you are at a given time and place. The other thing that that kind of measure really ignores is the fact that in a lot of these red states with high crime rates, those crime rates are primarily a function of the big blue cities within those states, right? So if you were to take Louisiana as an example, if you extracted Shreveport, Baton Rouge, and New Orleans, the state homicide rate would decline by about 30%. In Mississippi, if you were to extract Jackson, the state homicide rate would decline by almost 20%. So in a lot of these, you know, red states with high crime rates, we have to remember that it's often the blue cities within those states. And it's something that I think the American people have caught on to, because if you do look at the polling data, not only does it show that crime is a really big concern, but it also shows that Republicans are enjoying really large margins of advantage on that issue in particular, including among independent voters.
Yeah, I was looking actually because I saw Mississippi was the top ranked. And so I said, well, what's the largest city? Jackson. Okay, the district attorney there, Jody Owens, ran on a platform of being a reformer and a decarceral platform.
That's
and
exactly
he said that
right.
Like mass incarceration is actually the problem. But one of the Republican counterarguments is also, you know, hey, we were not the party that was for defund police. And I'm wondering, how much do you think does that argument resonate? Because we did see efforts initially to maybe talk about taking some funding away, and even some city councils did vote to shift funds, but then it never really happened. In fact, places like LA and other places actually ended up putting more money into police like a year after this debate began, right? And we started to see a reversal on the defund the police, that it just wasn't really working out.
Yeah, I mean, we did start to see a reversal, I think, because people understood very early on that that was a losing strategy. I think the Democrats overplayed their hand there and didn't realize the degree to which the vast majority of the American public thought that that was an absolutely insane tack to take. And so, you know, I'm glad that they pulled back, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't real harm done in the interim, right? Take New York City, for example. The city council voted to cut $1 billion of funding from the NYPD over a period of years. Now, yeah, they put a lot of that money back and had to spend more money than they planned to on overtime, but there were still two academy classes that were canceled, which means that there's a lag now in terms of those police officers finding their way out onto the street after graduating from the academy. And that matters at a time in which you're seeing, you know, retirements spike, you're seeing early resignations spike, not just in New York City, but in, you know, big urban departments across the country.
There was a Pew Research poll done, I'm sure you saw it, asked about the importance of crime to different racial and political groups. For conservatives, 77% said crime is a very important issue on which to vote. But it was even higher for Black voters. 81% said it was an important issue. But among Democrats broadly, just 33% said it was a top issue. What should political parties make of that or do with that?
Well, I think, you know, it's really just starkly illustrative of a dark reality about crime in the United States, and that is that it is very hyper-concentrated both geographically and demographically. If you look at the homicide victimization rate in this country for Black men, it's 10 times higher than it is for white men. And so it's perfectly understandable why this issue resonates so much more with Black voters, particularly in the Democratic Party. But the reality is that, you know, crime is very concentrated. It's experienced very differently among different populations. And one of the things that Democrats have been accused of is being indifferent to the suffering that's happening in the very populations that they claim to stand for. I mean, I just wrote a book, you know, about crime and policing and the incarceration debate. And the subtitle of the book is What the Push for Decarceration and Depolicing Gets Wrong and Who It Hurts Most. And the argument there is that, you know, if you look at who bears the brunt of the risk associated with soft on crime kind of policies? It's low-income minority communities. That's where the crime is the biggest problem, and that's who stands to lose the most if the Democrats are wrong about their policy push, and I think that they are.
To that point, in places like New York, you know, crime's been like the top issue, right? I think even some polling has it as bigger than inflation. And one of the big discussion points, and I know you can educate us on this, is this bail reform issue. I know other places have enacted bail reform or have no cash bail. I was reading, I think, Harris County, Texas has no cash bail. Santa Clara, California got rid of it during the pandemic. I think that has expired, though. Does no cash bail work, or does it really depend?
It depends. It can work in theory if you have a system in which you reorient the pretrial release inquiry around risk, right? So the main critique underlying bail reform pushes is that in a system that heavily relies on cash bail as the mechanism that determines whether or not somebody gets released pretrial, you end up dealing with these inequities and inefficiencies insofar as you can have, you know, really low risk but indigent defendants who get stuck behind bars, whereas high risk but well-off defendants get to buy their freedom, right? And so to address that problem, we can do a couple things. We can eliminate cash bail across the board, or we can minimize its importance by making whether or not someone gets released turn on the dangerousness that they pose to the community. Mm-hmm. Now, in some places like New Jersey, they have that ability. Judges can pull that lever in appropriate cases. What we find, though, is that the fact that on paper a judge can do that does not guarantee that they will do it in practice. And so, mm-hmm. you know, New Jersey just reformed its bail reform, even though that was one of the best, you know, sort of structured reforms in the country, by adding more gun crimes to the list of offenses that will trigger presumptions of detention because not enough judges were pulling that lever. And so when we talk about, you know, eliminating cash bail, we have to understand that even if we replace, you know, the cash with this ability of judges to jail people based on the dangerousness that they pose, there's no guarantee that they're going to do that. Now, what makes New York unique is that New York not only greatly restricted a judge's ability to impose cash bail, but they also are the only state in the union that prohibits judges from considering dangerousness in any aspect of the pretrial release inquiry. And that is why it's become such a hot button issue in New York.
Interesting. Okay. That clarifies a lot. Finally, what do Republicans do on crime? Like, let's say they take the House, maybe even the Senate. You know, crime and laws regarding bail, what's a felony or misdemeanor, reduced sentencing. I'm a Californian. I know all of that is very localized. In fact, at the I guess at the highest level, really, it's a state issue, right? Like with Prop 47 and 57. Yep. We know police reform bills in Congress didn't go through. So all these Republicans running on crime, let's say they win. What can they do?
They can do a few things from the federal perch. One thing that they can do is use the power of the purse to fund the hiring of more police officers, which is something that was a really successful initiative undertaken as part of the 1994 crime bill, which sought to add 100,000 police officers to the street. I think the last analysis I saw of that was that about 75,000 police officers were added to the street. Some subset of that number was a function of officers being able to stop doing clerical duties because the departments were able to hire administrative staff. So that's step one that I think can be taken. Step two is that, you know, the department does have resources at its disposal, the Department of Justice, that is,
right,
that it can decide to put in different places. And, you know, one thing that the department can do is place a greater emphasis on building out joint task forces with local police departments and make serious cases against the drivers of violence, right? We know that in every given community, it's only a very small share of potential offenders that are driving the vast majority of the serious violent crime. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there are other inducements that the federal government can put together to try and get states to adopt better rules. And that was something else that was a feature of the 1994 crime bill.
Rafael Manguel at the Manhattan Institute, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
This is Tammy Bruce with your Fox News commentary coming up.
It's the economy.
We hear that election after election, and this cycle has been no different. Inflation, what we're paying for everyday things, for gas, for food, has consistently topped opinion polls of voters the last several months. So on this midterm election eve, what is the health of the economy? We've had some new data with the Labor Department's jobs reports last week showing a better than expected 261,000 jobs added in October, and the unemployment rate ticking up slightly to 3.7%, historically pretty low.
It's great to see people, employees, earning more money, earning more revenue, and we want to see that. We want to see people be able to make more money and be able to put more money in the bank. But clearly, with inflation at around 8%, a little higher, we have more work to do there as a government, as a country, as an economy. And it's, you know, the thing about this is it's not just here in the United States, it's across the globe. So these pressures are all across the globe. So everyone's trying to figure out how do we bring these costs down.
That is Labor Secretary Marty Walsh speaking with Fox Business Network's Edward Lawrence, who explains how the Federal Reserve is trying to do just that.
The Federal Reserve did want to see a slower jobs report.
Fox Business Network's White House correspondent, Edward Lawrence.
But we got 261,000 jobs added back to the economy in the month of October, and that is more than the Federal Reserve would expect. The market was expecting 200,000 jobs. So that shows, that signals now to the Federal Reserve, good news is bad news for the Fed. That signals that, yes, they still have room to increase, to be more aggressive with rate hikes because the labor market can handle it. You're looking at job openings. We still have 10.7 million job openings. You've got the unemployment rate near historic lows. The Federal Reserve believes it will end this year at 3.8%, so that's still more room to move up and more pain to be felt by Americans. You know, the neutral rate, which the Fed talks about, generally speaking, they believe it's somewhere around 4.1% for unemployment. That means they think the unemployment rate should be 4.1% to have sort of a standard baseline market. There's a long way to go there, and that's a lot more economic pain, as the Federal Reserve Chairman had said.
Is part of that unemployment rate because of inflation? I had seen, and you're the expert on this, so I'll sort of ask you the question, as I was asking myself as I read this sort of analysis piece, that one of the issues that then occur in a labor market like we have right now is job seekers can be pretty selective, right? There are a lot of them and not as many jobs, and that can make wages go up, it can make benefits go up, and all of that is sort of baked into the price that is passed on to consumers.
And that's exactly right. That's what's happening. And that leads to a wage price spiral, which is something they don't want to see happen. That's where you have companies paying workers more to attract them. The workers then, the product then that they make costs more because the labor, you know, they're being paid more. So then therefore, the workers will go out and ask for even more money because the products they want to buy are more expensive. And it's a spiral that keeps going. That is what the Fed does not want to see. And at the moment, I've heard Federal Reserve Fed presidents say that that is not what's happening yet. They're not seeing that as of yet, but they are seeing inflation being more entrenched in this economy. Core inflation is actually rising. That's without food and energy prices. And that's a big issue for the Federal Reserve because that means it's not just the volatile energy prices that comes with gas. As gas goes down, price goes down, inflation comes down. That's the more entrenched inflation in products that are made and sold. And that core inflation is rising, and that is a very big concern for the Federal Reserve. It could tell them that it will take longer to get rid of the inflation that we're seeing, and that would lead to a fact where we might have not just a rate hike at the next meeting, but in January and possibly beyond January.
It sounds backwards because politicians love when unemployment's down and wages are up.
It does sound backwards, right? But here's a big problem. I mean, you talk about wages. Wages in this report up 4.7% year over year. Now, that increase is declining. So that's not a good thing because that means it's getting farther away from where inflation is at 8.2%. So workers are generally, their dollars are not going as far as they would like them or need them to go. So It's a good report when you look at it from 36,000 feet, but when you get down into the report, there are cracks in it that people are feeling, and you see it in the polls. I mean, that wage increase at 4.7% year over year, and you have 8.2% inflation, that is reflected in the poll numbers, which are trending towards Republicans, because people go to the grocery store, they go to the gas station, they go to buy Christmas presents, and they said, oh my gosh, last year I was paying much less than this. What happened? And what happened was the policies of the president, according to Republicans.
So if you're the Federal Reserve, you look at this jobs report, you say, wow, we need to continue sort of doing what we're doing. Do you expect then the basis point increase to remain at that 0.75? Did they go a full point? I mean, or explain to me sort of the context of what we have already seen the Sure. Fed do from sort of the beginning of this economic downturn to where we are now.
Sure. You know, we've already had 6 rate hikes this year. 4 of those rate hikes have been at 75 basis points. That is a historical record for the Federal Reserve. They have never seen consecutive interest rate hikes at this level, at this very aggressive level. And they expect December is going to be the same. The market expects, a vast majority expects, another 75 basis points at this next meeting. Now, beyond December into next year, there's some cracks sort of forming in the narrative we're hearing from the Federal Reserve. There was a Federal Reserve president speaking after the jobs report came out, and she had said, the Boston Federal Reserve president said, that 75 basis points is in the argument, is they're talking about for the next meeting, but she believes that a 50 basis point move, a half a percent move, could be considered in this next and the meetings after. And that's significant because she's a voting member, so she will be the one of the people deciding. But they're looking at the jobs report that just came out, which is hot. They're going to get another inflation report that comes out. If that comes in with core inflation again not budging, they're going to have to be more aggressive. So you'll probably see the 75 basis point hike in December. That's been signaled, that's been baked into the market. And you're starting to see that, hey, let's wait and see. There's a lag effect to what the Fed does, because their policies take about 6 to 8 months to work. So we'd have to see what kind of harm we've caused to the economy before.
Or if it went the other way and they've been making all of these rate adjustments without needing to do it.
Right. Exactly. And that, and which would lead us into a longer, deeper recession.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem. And this is the guessing game that goes on. You look at the data now and then you predict what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, boy, how often has the Fed projections been correct? They haven't. Over the
economics
past decade.
Economics was not my strongest subject in school, and it's starting to make sense to me why. let me ask this, because one thing that the administration says, and listen, there is truth to it, is that inflation is a global issue right now. You look at inflation rates in developed economies around the world, and it's high, right? In many cases, worse than it is in this country.
Yes.
So, I mean, if this is a global challenge, are the Fed's hands tied a little bit?
No, because our market, our economy is so large. We drive what happens around the rest of the globe. Now, yes, sometimes things that happen in other large economies like China and the United Kingdom, France, for example, can seep into the United States. But generally, our economy is so large that what happens around the globe won't really affect what happens here. But what happens here will affect the rest of the globe, which is another reason the Federal Reserve wants to get inflation under control. Because if we're seeing inflation in the U.S., that will spread to the rest of the world and matriculate into their markets, partly because and put other countries into recession. And this is what David Malpass, the head of the World Bank, this is his point, is that as the Federal Reserve keeps raising interest rates, it's making the dollar stronger and stronger. And that is really hurting the buying power in other countries and slowing other countries' economies down, smaller economies, and slowing them down and pushing them into recession. So unless inflation can be handled now quickly, then the higher interest rates will push more and more and more countries into recession around the globe the farther out we go as we deal with inflation.
As we look at this from the election tomorrow, then does a Republican Congress change the thinking of the Fed? The Fed's obviously an independent agency. They are nominated by the sitting president. But does who is in the House chamber or the Senate chamber matter much to members of the Federal Reserve?
Yes. And the reason it matters is because only Congress has oversight over the Federal Reserve. The president gets to appoint members to the Fed, but the actual oversight happens from Congress. So, yes, it does matter for the Federal Reserve. Now, will they change course? No. They are looking at inflation, and that is their number one topic, their number one issue, their number one concern. Because on the labor side, on the job side, they've met their mandate. They're near record low unemployment rate. They've got everybody working. They've added back all the jobs that were lost during the pandemic, and the economy has now created 804,000 jobs beyond that. So the labor side of their mandate is perfect. The inflation part, the price stability part of their mandate is a mess, and they have to get that under control.
We will see how it plays out now in the weeks and months ahead, a big challenge that the Federal Reserve is trying to tackle. Edward Lawrence covers it all for us at the Fox Business Network at his White House perch. Appreciate the time as always.
Thanks, Jared. I appreciate it.
Here's a look at the week ahead.
Monday.
Former President Trump holds a rally for Republican candidates in Dayton, Ohio, just hours before polls open for the November midterms. Tuesday is Election Day, with the outcome of the Senate and House races set to determine which political party controls Congress from next January until the 2024 balloting. Polling shows Republicans are likely to regain control of the House. The Senate leadership is still up in the air. Other races will also determine the leadership of a number of states and who will oversee future elections in those states.
Thursday.
The U.S. and Japan begin joint military exercises. About 36,000 personnel, 30 ships, and more than 350 aircraft are set to take part. It comes amid high tensions in the Korean Peninsula, with North Korea conducting dozens of missile tests. Friday is Veterans Day, as Americans honor the men and women who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces. And that's a look at your week ahead. I'm Rich Dennison, Fox News.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Tammy Bruce. What's on your mind?
Do the Democrats want to win the midterm elections? Their actions indicate that either they don't want to win or they don't care and are focused only on dividing this country beyond repair. After all, you learn a lot about people when they're under pressure or when they're not getting something that they want. During the last few months, as it became clear they were losing the electoral arguments because of their disastrous policies, the Democrats decided to accuse half the country of being fascist, racist, bigoted, and threats to democracy. We are now witnessing the Democrats' panic meltdown, providing the only real transparency we will ever see from Biden and his gang. When Joe Biden announced that he was going to deliver another lecture at the American people about threats to democracy last week, it was obvious the Democrats learned nothing from the debacle of his now infamous September 1st super ultra MAGA semi-fascist speech in Philadelphia. Widely viewed as an attempt by a confused Barney Fife to channel Darth Vader, it was a speech meant to condemn and isolate half of the American people. Let's just say voters were not impressed after listening to Biden declare tens of millions of Americans as, oddly, semi-fascist. The reaction to this absurdity was evident as the midterm polls started to collapse, even more for the semi-hapless and fully panicked Democrats. It's not just Biden and the malign fools running the White House that have revealed their utter contempt for the American people. The clown car that is The View flipped over when reacting to a poll revealing white suburban women are breaking for the GOP. Of course they are. Everyone is breaking for the GOP. Democrats have made life unpredictable and dangerous and the future menacing. But Sunny Hostin had a different assessment about women who dared to not pay allegiance to the leftist narrative and are actually concerned instead about whether they could afford eggs for breakfast, have gas in the car, and enough money to heat the house this winter. She said, "What's also surprising to me is the abortion issue. I read a poll just yesterday that white Republican suburban women are now going to vote Republican. It's almost like roaches voting for Raid, right? Here's a news flash for Sunny. It's going to be more than white Republican women voting for Republicans. It's women everywhere, of many complexions. Women can be concerned about a variety of issues and then prioritize them. We also refuse to be manipulated, threatened, and demeaned by celebrities and politicians simply because we're making choices that are best for ourselves and our families. In the meantime, the postmillennial reported presidential historian and unhinged leftist Michael Beschloss had his own panic attack about the midterms, telling MSNBC that we, quote, could be 6 days away from losing our rule of law, and that we are on the edge of a brutal authoritarian system where children will be arrested and conceivably killed. The only things Beschloss left out of the impending GOP hellscape was the threat of dogs and cats sleeping together and the stay-puffed marshmallow man rampaging through Midtown Manhattan. The shocking revelations about the Democrats' agenda and attitude is not an election closing argument filled with well-meaning but dumb rhetoric. Quite the opposite. It's not well-meaning or rhetoric. It really is the truth of what they think of us. This is perhaps the most important lesson we can learn after everything we've been through. The Democrats and their leftist bosses know what they've done to the country and to our lives, and they will never stop if we don't take an undeniable stand now. This is Tammy Bruce. I'm a Fox News contributor, and this column originally appeared at amac.us.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.